1, verses 1 to 7, which is on page 509. No, it's probably not actually, because I've got a church Bible. It's on page 635 of the... that's fine. Page 635 if you've got a red Bible. So the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. For gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance, for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. I want you to imagine the start of a university term. It's Freshers Week, and Mr. and Mrs. Solomon have dropped off their son at university. And I imagine it's the kind of usual conversations, you know, if you've got more than one set of bedding, remember the kettle, try to ring us at some point in term. And then before the farewell is, by the way, son, just a few words of advice. I reckon that's probably the closest you get to the background of Proverbs, actually. If you look at it, you get this repeated description, chapter 1, verse 8, listen, my son. My son, verse 10, chapter 2, verse 1, my son, if you accept my words, chapter 3, verse 1, my son, and so on. Here what you get in Proverbs is, if you like, instructions, I suspect, to a young son as they're setting on in life. You know, here's how to do life well. I have to be honest, I've always thought Proverbs should be required reading for any Christian about to leave home. They should only be allowed to leave home once they've read and understood and maybe even memorized Proverbs. But it might be that you're sitting here thinking, yeah, young might be a little bit of a stretch for me. You know, I kind of like to think of myself as still young, but maybe describing myself as young is sort of slightly beyond the realms of credibility at this point. Well, have a look at verse 5. Let the wise listen and add to their learning. So as well as being a speech for those who are young, this collection is also useful for those who are already wise. And hopefully over the next 45 minutes or so, you'll be able to add to your wisdom. Now, if Job was hard to do in a single session, in many ways it's even more the case that this is madness with Proverbs. Because the amount of material is just vast. Chapters 1 to 9 are probably a series of speeches that it is in the context of Solomon addressing his son. And then from chapter 10 through to chapter 29, you get probably what Proverbs is best known for. The kind of pithy verses where two things are contrasted or built upon. Sayings that are useful to remember. Chapter 30, you get other material from this mysterious figure, Agur. And then in 31, chapter 31 starts with King Lemuel passing on what's been taught by his mother. And actually, chapter 31, the beginning of, I think, is a really important passage if you want to know what the Bible says government rulers should be like. Proverbs 31 is an important section to consider that. Before you end with this wife of noble character, who may be wisdom personified, or it might simply be that one of the big decisions for Solomon's son to make is who he should marry. But whatever, what you see in Proverbs is the whole of life being covered. In many ways, I think Proverbs is one of the most helpful books in the Bible for considering how you live outside church. You know, most books in the Bible, I guess, yeah, there's quite a lot of how do we live as God's people, how do we function within the church, and so on. Proverbs is very much the whole of life is dealt with. How to live God's way across the sweep of things. And so there's a whole load of issues in Proverbs that I'm not going to really touch on beyond mentioning a single verse. So Proverbs will teach us how to work hard. Proverbs 10, he who gathers crops in summer is a prudent son, but he who sleeps during harvest is a disgraceful son. And Proverbs is a book that will encourage us to work hard, not to be a sluggard who sort of turns like a hinge in their bed. Proverbs is really useful when it comes to thinking about speaking wisely or even not speaking a huge amount. Sin is not ended by multiplying words, but the prudent hold their tongues. You know, Proverbs is a great book to think about not speaking rashly from. It's a great book to think about how to make plans, or more, how you make plans but trust God with the outcome. In our hearts, humans plan their course, but the Lord establishes their steps. I think Proverbs has got one of the most powerful descriptions of wisdom about wealth. Actually, this is in Agur's material in chapter 30. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal, and so may dishonor the name of my God. And he's saying, actually, the best is not to be really poor or actually to be really rich, but just to have enough. There's even dietary advice. Eat honey, my son, for it is good. And so you get the whole sweep of life covered in the book of Proverbs. And again, rather as with Job, my aim in this session is not for you to be able to say, tick, we've done Proverbs, so much as to whet your appetite. Ooh, I'd quite like to dig into stuff about work and money and speech and plans and even dietary advice. I want to read Proverbs for myself. I don't know, a proverb a day keeps, I don't know, something bad away. That might be one way of approaching it. But what I'm going to do for the rest of this is look at Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7 to the end of the chapter. And I'm not going to stick in it. I'm going to do what I wouldn't normally do and springboard a bit into the rest of the book. But it gives us three headings that I think summarize well the message of Proverbs. So, if we're young, listen. This is how to do life well. If you're already wise, listen so that you can add to your wisdom. Here's the thing. Fear the Lord. Fear the Lord. Chapter 1, verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. I think if you want a title for Proverbs, that's not a bad one. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. How do you want to know? How do you live wisely in this world? Above all else, you live wisely in this world by fearing God. In fact, I think you could argue that's almost the headline for wisdom literature as a whole. It comes up in Job 28:28, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. And if you were here last week, you remember that in a sense, the ultimate moment in Job comes as Job is confronted with the sheer grandeur of God in creation. And he bows before God in awe. It's the headline we'll see next week in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes leads up to the point of saying, fear God and keep his commandments. That is the sum total of what it is to be human. And so the fear of God becomes a recurring theme within wisdom literature. If you like, how do you live wisely in the world? You recognize that God is the creator and I am a creature. God is God, I am not. I don't get to be, at least I don't want to be, independent. I don't want to live as though I'm a sort of autonomous human being who isn't answerable to God. I'm at my best when I recognize my place before him, a dependent creature who needs to learn from him. And I think that's the sense that you get as you look at the next reference to fearing God. So Proverbs 3 verse 7, do not be wise in your own eyes, fear the Lord and shun evil. So maybe you're thinking, what does it mean to fear the Lord? Well, fearing the Lord involves not seeing myself as the fount of all wisdom. Don't be wise in your own eyes. In other words, I recognize my limits. I recognize the limits to my understanding, my ability to see the future, to make good decisions. Don't be wise in my own eyes. Instead, fear God. Recognize he's the source of wisdom. He knows better than I do. In every decision, I want to be asking the question, what does God say? What does God think? And bow before him as I make decisions in life, because he knows better than I do. And then let me give you just a series of other proverbs later in the book around this theme of fearing the Lord. So you get the fear of the Lord adds length to life, but the years of the wicked are cut short. Or again, whoever fears the Lord has a secure fortress, and for their children it will be a refuge. Or, the fear of the Lord is a fountain of life, turning a person from the snares of death. Better a little, Proverbs 15 says, with the fear of the Lord than great wealth with turmoil. And Proverbs 19, the fear of the Lord leads to life, then one rests content, untouched by trouble. And then you get the last section of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 31, where you do have this sort of slightly idealized picture, thanks Sharon, this slightly idealized picture of a woman to marry. And I think the reason it's a woman to marry is just because that's the theme of the book. Solomon is giving advice to his son. And the last couple of verses are fascinating because this is what is said. Charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord is to be praised. And I guess it's asking the question, what is the ideal characteristic, frankly, actually, for any human being? And one of the things that we tend to value as society is we value easy charm, don't we? You know, the person who's, I don't know, witty and eloquent and just sort of relates to people. And, you know, those of us who possess those kind of things is, you know, it's just easy charm, isn't it? And people admire it and think, oh, yeah, no, isn't it nice being around people who just have that ability to sort of look and act vaguely cool and charming? But in the end, that's deceptive. Because actually, you can have that easy, cool charm, witty eloquence, and yet be a monster on the inside. Actually doesn't reveal about anything about anybody's character at all, that kind of charm. And he also says, you know, beauty is fleeting. Let's be honest, as we get older, slightly more lines tend to appear in our face, and the, you know, the hairline for some of us goes backwards, and you know, the sort of beauty that we had as we look back at photos of us 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, gosh, didn't I look good? And we look in the mirror now and it's not quite the same. I mean, I'm sure none of us have gone through that experience as I look out at you, but you know, there is, charm is deceptive. but you know, there is the sort of fleeting nature of beauty, isn't it? It doesn't last, actually. And so actually, if you want to be a character who is transformed on the inside and who has a stability that doesn't rely on physical beauty, and indeed if you want to marry such a person, the characteristic to look for is somebody who fears the Lord. That's the thing that transforms inside and outside, that is lasting, and so on. And so what you get as you put all these things together is that the fear of the Lord is positive, adds length to life, has a secure fortress, is a fountain of life. It's actually better to fear the Lord than to have great wealth. It leads to life and contentment. Now, it's worth saying that proverbs aren't promises. You know, as we work our way through wisdom literature, we're dealing with different genres of literature. And so take something like the fear of the Lord adds length to life. Yeah, we can't look at, say, a Christian who's died young and say, well, clearly they didn't fear the Lord. No, that'd be scandalous. Rather, it's a sense of this is generally speaking how life works. That the best way of going through life is to fear God. And that makes sense, doesn't it? Because actually, if we fear God, we're living in line with how creation works. If God is the creator, we're his creatures. The best way to live, the best way to have a harmonious life, to live in the sweep of things rather than at odds with creation, it is to fear God, is to walk in his ways. It is the best way to live. It is better than having wealth. Don't really notice, actually, if you have wealth and you have lots of stuff, it's basically just more stuff to go wrong. you know, actually, bizarrely, having lots of stuff can just add stress to life. Gosh, that's another gadget that can malfunction. Or what am I going to do with this wealth? Can I be? Will I lose it? Whereas actually, the writer is saying the best way to live is to have enough, and then to say, my life is rock solid in that I know God is my creator, and I'm living his way. And as such, it is secure. I am secure. To fear God is the best way to live, and it's better than wealth, and it's better than charm, and it's better than beauty, because it is lasting and permanent. And as we have it, it is, as the writer says, this secure fortress. I know one or two home groups have been looking at Mike Reeves' book, Rejoice and Tremble. And the thing I like about the book, it's all about the fear of God. The first chapter is fascinating because he talks about the fear of God and then contrasts it with today's culture of fear. And he notices that in many ways, society has never been safer. You know, it has never been safer to live than, I mean, ignoring pandemics slightly, but broadly speaking, people live longer than they've ever lived, people are more secure, people are more safe. And at the same time, people are more paranoid than ever before. You think of the paranoia about diet, or people needing safe spaces to be free from anything that might be conceivably offensive, or the way in which health and safety regulations keep expanding and expanding and expanding, despite the fact that basically we're much safer than we've ever been. And his point is this: once you stop fearing God, you will start fearing everything else. Here's how he puts it. In our digitalized world, the speed at which information and news are disseminated means that we're flooded with more cause of worry than ever. Do you notice that, actually? More source of information just means, actually, in the end, more things to worry about. More things that could wrong. Ah, no, what about terror? When actually the percentage is, we're safe. With society having lost God as the proper object of healthy fear, our culture is necessarily becoming ever more neurotic, ever more anxious about the unknown, indeed more anxious about anything and everything. I think that's right, actually. You know, the phone-ins where you pick up, you know, what if this happens? What if that happens? When actually, ironically, we are safer than we've ever been. And actually, if you lose the fear of God, you don't walk around in freedom, you just fear everything else. The old hymn, fear him, you saints, and you will then have nothing left to fear. And I want to encourage us that actually if we have that reverent sense, God is God and I'm not, and I want to walk in his ways, then that's actually going to be a secure fortress for some of us. Something that's healthy, something that enables us to be content. The other thing, I guess, that this positive image of fearing the Lord, that it represents this secure fortress for us, means that fearing the Lord must be something healthy. In other words, it can't be that fearing the Lord implies this sort of utter craven terror. You know, this kind of, oh no, I'm hating my life because I'm desperately fearing what God might do to me. That doesn't sound very secure fortress-like. That sounds pretty grim. Now, this fear of the Lord is this reverence that acknowledges him as our creator, and it also rests secure in his love. Listen to this. Again, it's Mike Reeves who quotes this, actually. C.H. Spurgeon, the preacher of the 19th century, says this: I love to hear my heavenly Father's voice in the thunder. And what he meant by that was, you know, imagine the kind of thunderstorm. And, you know, they're quite awesome, aren't they, thunderstorms, where, you know, the thunder is sort of resonating around, and there's some sense of awe in that. And Spurgeon is saying, actually, as he felt the awe of the thunder, he immediately thought, actually, that's my Father's voice. The one who is this awesome creator is my Heavenly Father. And so rightly I fear him, rightly I reverence him, but with a security that he's the Father who is loving and compassionate, that this fear is not craven terror so much as an awe at his glory. And Proverbs is saying that awe at his glory, that recognizes his authority, is healthy for us. And I guess my question is simply, when were we last there? When were we last in that sense of to fear you, Lord God, to bow in awe before your authority, to recognize your glory, to recognize you're God and I'm not, is the best way to live. Paul Tripp, the American counselor, has written a book called Awe. And he said he wrote it because he was concerned about awe amnesia. In other words, a sense of forgetting to bow before God. He says awe amnesia leads to awe replacement. You know, when you don't bow in awe fearing God, you end up bowing in awe before something else. And so the first lesson of Proverbs is simply this. We want to fear God. You know, son, as you set out on life, the most important thing you need to know is God and you're not. And your life will go much better if you get that early. And actually, for those of us who may, even in our later years, still be in need of wisdom, it's still healthy for us to fear God. God is God, and I'm not. Well, I'm going to give you a break so you don't fall asleep. But mainly, actually, so you can talk to each other and discuss things. So a couple of questions, I think, going to appear on the screen for about 7 or 8 minutes. So if fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, what helps you to fear the Lord and how can we grow in it? So feel free. There'll be more chance, there'll be a bit of chance to pray in groups at the end. So there's the first thing, fear of the Lord. Here's the second thing. Solomon wants his son and even those of us who already have some wisdom to know, learn how to say no. Learn how to say no. So you get verse 8 of chapter 1. Let's go back there. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction. Do not forsake your mother's teaching. There are garlands to grace your head and a chain to adorn your neck. Just some wisdom for teenagers. Occasionally parents do say stuff that's useful. But then verse 10. My son, if sinful men entice you, do not give in to them. Do not give in to them. And basically, verse 10 all the way through to verse 19, it is largely a warning against peer pressure. Essentially, the concern is that this son will be led into sin by others. Now, the example that is given is fairly extreme. You know, you've got this sort of gang getting together in verse 11. Let's lie in wait for innocent blood. Let's ambush some harmless soul. And so literally, actually, the point of verses 10 to 15 is if somebody encourages you to participate in robbery with violence, don't do it. That, can I just give that as advice? If somebody encourages you to participate in robbery with violence, don't. That's probably advice you already knew. My son, do not go along with them. Do not set foot on their paths. Why? Well, because it's a pathway to disaster. Verse 18, these men lie in wait for their own blood. They ambush only themselves. And the point actually, ultimately, despite the kind of extreme example, is that sense of, actually, if you go along with others who aren't living in the fear of the Lord, it becomes the pathway to your own destruction. It becomes a pathway to disaster. And so one of the things that these people need to know is, don't go in. Don't go along with what other people want you to do that will lead you away from God's plan for your life. And there's another example of that when you get into chapter 5. Do you want to flick through to chapter 5, verse 1 to 6? My son, chapter 5, verse 1, pay attention to my wisdom. Turn your ear to my words of insight, that you may maintain discretion and your lips may preserve knowledge. The lips of the adulterous woman drip honey, and her speech is smoother than oil. But in the end, she is bitter as gall, sharp as a double-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps lead straight to the grave. She gives no thought to the way of life. Her paths wander aimlessly, but she does not know it. Now, why is it that Solomon is warning particularly about a woman? I guess in this case, it's because he's addressing his son. And so the warning is against being led astray into sexual immorality. You find it repeated in chapter 7, verse 21. With persuasive words, she led him astray. She seduced him with her smooth talk. All at once, he followed her like an ox going to the slaughter, like a deer stepping into a noose, till an arrow pierces his liver, like a bird darting into a snare, little knowing it will cost him his life. There's a fairly sober warning here that sexual immorality is the thing that can lead you astray, lead you away from living life as it's meant to be. And of course, it's a powerful force. I totally understand why this is addressed to this young man. Don't let sexual attraction lead you away from living for God. You know, over the years, I've sat opposite a number of youngish guys, just really attracted to that non-Christian girl in my college. And you know, I suspect we might end up doing something together. How do I avoid doing it? I've had that conversation multiple times over the years. Oh, in the Lord's grace, for the most part, actually, they've resisted and gone on to serve the Lord. But it was a crucial moment of decision, actually, as to which direction they would go. Now, of course, there's forgiveness for failure, but I've also had conversations with people who know forgiveness but do regret the failures. And here's just the warning. Don't give in to peer pressure. Don't give in to sexual immorality. You see, in many ways, what chapter 1 and I think chapters 5 to 7 are essentially saying is this. To live in fear of God, you also need to develop a backbone. You need to develop a backbone that fears God and then says no to others. To say, no, whatever other people are saying I should do, whatever mockery I get, whatever temptations come at me, fear of God means I'm going to say no to others. And of course, the challenges will change as we get older. By and large, I think, as we get older, the changes shift slightly, at least from in the area of sexuality to in the area of finance. And the temptation becomes, let's just settle down and be comfortable and have what everybody else has and live for ourselves financially. And fear of God means we're going to learn to say no. There's a title of a book that I love, When People Are Big and God Is Small. And it picks up the danger that's being hinted at in Proverbs of reversing what should be the case. Proverbs is saying God should be big and by contrast, people in their opinion, small. Sin comes when we reverse that. And God is small and people are big. Now, having said that, Proverbs is not suggesting this sort of rugged isolationist. You know, whatever anybody else says, I'm going to stand firm and live for God. Because actually, Proverbs says there are people you want to say yes to. Again, it becomes quite a theme. The righteous choose their friends carefully, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. Walk with the wise and become wise, for a companion of fools suffers harm. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. The pleasantness of a friend springs from their heartfelt advice. And so, in a sense, what Proverbs is saying is not so much don't go along with anybody, it's rather choose the right people to go along with. Choose those who are going to be helpful for you. Choose actually those who aren't necessarily going to flatter you. I think this is where Proverbs is quite countercultural, isn't it? To be honest, quite a good qualification for my friends is they think I'm marvellous. I quite like having friends who think I'm marvellous, but actually it's not necessarily good for me. And besides, I can't find that many. But, you know, it's actually the true friend is the one who will say, Andy, why do you do that? Do you reckon that's the best path? And often, actually, culturally, we think when people question us, oh, they can't be a good friend. Actually, it's when people question us that we should be thinking, gosh, what a good friend, that they're willing to do that. Wounds from a friend can be trusted. And Proverbs is saying, actually, if we want to do life well, we won't go with peer pressure, but we do want to surround ourselves with friends who are pleasant, who are good, and who sometimes can ask good questions of us. And it might be that actually one of the calls of this is just to be more proactive with that. Often, I bump into people and they're thinking, oh, I'd really like to spend more time with that person. And then I talk to that person, I'd really like to spend more time with that person. And Parley just says, will you please ask each other to spend more time? Do you know what I mean? Sometimes it can just be good to be proactive in friendships and to say, hey, should we get together? Should we go have a coffee every so often? Learn to say no, but also learn to say yes, if you like, to the right people. Now, as I say, rather like last week, this is rather me throwing a load of sort of spaghetti at the wall and seeing what sticks. A lot of material. Just hold on to what the Lord impresses on your heart. fear of the Lord, learn to say no and yes. And then lastly, listen to wisdom. Listen to wisdom. Because the scene shifts in the latter part of chapter 1. So Proverbs chapter 1 and verse 20 onwards. And the scene has shifted to the public square. If you like, imagine, I don't know, corn market on a Saturday afternoon. And out in the open, wisdom calls aloud. She raises her voice in the public square. On top of the wall, she cries out. At the city gate, she makes her speech. And so here we're to imagine corn market Saturday afternoon, and there's a woman shouting from the top of Carfax Tower. And she's wisdom, calling out, listen to me, listen to me. You want to do life well? Listen to me. Sadly, nobody's listening. How long will you who are simple love your simple ways? How long will mockers delight in mockery and fools hate knowledge? She's kind of pleading with people to listen. But the reality, end of chapter 1, verse 29, they hated knowledge, did not choose to fear the Lord. They would not accept my advice and spurned my rebuke. And wisdom is saying, listen to me, this is how to do life. People, by and large, are rejecting that. And so you find two alternative outcomes. The waywardness of the simple will kill them. The complacency of fools will destroy them. But whoever listens to me will live in safety and be at ease without fear of harm. And so you get this image of wisdom crying out, saying, again, this is the best way to live. It's not, we know it's not the case that if somebody listens to wisdom, they'll never come to any harm, but they won't come to ultimate harm. You know, their life, their eternity will be secure. And you find this choice, the, you know, away from wisdom, disaster, towards wisdom is life. That reaches its climax in chapter 9. Now, chapter 9 is all about parties. Sorry, I know it's Sunday afternoon. I know you're tired. But hey, it is party time in Proverbs chapter 9. And there are essentially two different parties you can go to. So have a flick to chapter 9. Because wisdom has set up, has built her house with its seven pillars, prepared her meat and mixed her wine, set her table, sent out her servants from the highest point of the city. She's saying, let all who are simple come to my house. Come, eat my food. Drink the wine I've mixed. Leave your simple ways and you'll live. Walk in the way of insight. Hey, party time at wisdom's house. And it's also party time at folly's house. Folly, verse 13, is an unruly woman. She's simple and she knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house on a seat at the highest point of the city and she's inviting people in. Lord, all who are simple, come to my house. Stolen water is sweet, food eaten in secret is delicious. And so, hey, choice of parties. But with folly, little do they know that the dead are there, that her guests are deep in the realm of the dead. And gosh, that's quite brutal, isn't it? It's actually saying there are two choices. You know, as you go through life, which party are you going to attend? In many ways, as you think about the whole of life, as you think about speech, as you think about money, as you think about friendships, as you think about sex, which party are you going to go to? That's basically the decision every time we go through life. Whose party will we attend? Will we choose the wisdom party, fearing God and keeping his commandments? Or will we go to folly's party, trusting our own judgment, being wise in our own eyes? I think of all the books of the Bible, Proverbs is the one that's constantly saying, hey, two roads, choose. Again and again in Proverbs. Which party are you going to go to? Who are you going to listen to? Choose. But as I draw to a close, there's one last thing to say about wisdom. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 13. Blessed are those who find wisdom, those who gain understanding. For she is more profitable than silver and yields better returns than gold. She's more precious than rubies. Nothing you desire can compare with her. Gosh, wisdom's precious, valuable, beautiful. Nothing can compare with wisdom. And then in Proverbs 8, you have wisdom speaking. And she says, I was there with God when the world was made. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in the human race. And you have this beautiful image of God is there creating the world and there's wisdom next to him, enjoying what he's doing. And so it becomes no surprise that as you get into the New Testament, Jesus Christ is described as our wisdom. And actually, of course, if you think about the sermon, it's funny, I was at Trinity this morning preaching this passage at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus, our wisdom, is the one who offers two roads, doesn't he, if you think about it? Narrow is the road that leads to life. Wide is the road that leads to destruction. Where are you going to build your house? Are you going to build your house on the foundation of rock or on sand? And just as in Proverbs 9 is saying, you've got two roads, choose. When Christ comes as our wisdom, he says, come to me. If you like, I am inviting you to wisdom's party. But if you reject me, you will end up walking the road of folly and death. And so Solomon is just blunt in chapter 4. Get wisdom. Want advice on how to do life well? Get wisdom. Which actually, for the Christian, is get Jesus. Get Jesus. You're about to start your road of life. The most important thing you can do is get Jesus. Because there's two roads. You're going to have to choose. Jesus is saying, come my road. It's narrow. But it leads to life. And so, you can understand why Proverbs is so relevant to those who are young, actually. Big choices ahead. And the vital choice for anybody young is to say, fear God. God is God, I'm not. And that means I'm not going to just go with the flow and go with the crowd. I'm going to fear God and I'm going to value Jesus as more precious than anything else in the world. I tell you, actually, when young people make those sort of choices, boy, have they got potential to do life well. And tragically, actually, when people don't make those choices and choose to be wise in their own eyes, to choose to go along with everything else and to value other things higher than Jesus, that's pathway to disaster. They'll say many of us won't be at the big decisions of life ahead of us, but day by day we make decisions. And Proverbs is saying, choose them wisely. Don't trust your own judgment, fear God. Don't go with the crowd. Surround yourself with good friends who are going to help you. And above all else, value Jesus, because he is more precious than anything else in the world. Well, why don't you go back into your groups and pray?